This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Can white supremacy be cured? One researcher says the racist mindset can be similar to addiction. It can be hard to stop the hateful thoughts, even if you want to. Matthew DeMichel is a senior research sociologist with RTI International's Applied Justice Division. He studied former white supremacists to find out why they join hate groups and why they leave. Matthew DeMichel, welcome to the State. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
You did in-depth interviews with dozens of former white supremacists. What were you talking about? What did you want to know?
Yeah, so we did in-depth life history interviews with 47 former white supremacists across the United States. And we interviewed these individuals probably in about just over 30 states about their attraction to, participation in, and exit from extremism. And the interviews, to give you a little context, the interviews lasted between 6 and 8 hours. We audio recorded the interviews and we transcribed them word for word.
All right. So these are former. These are people who have left for one reason or another.
Exactly.
Tell us why you chose to talk with them.
Well, that's a good question. Well, one reason is, first of all, we wanted to understand exit. And so that was a very important issue to us. So understanding what people call disengagement and de-radicalization was a central theme of this study. And also, in some ways, it was a population that we could get access to. It's far more difficult to ask these types of questions for current members of white supremacist organizations for maybe some obvious sorts of reasons.
Yeah, they may not want to talk.
Right.
But one of the main conclusions, and this I find fascinating, one of the main conclusions from your research is that extreme racism is more a consequence of joining the group rather than a reason to join.
Yeah, I think that's been a key point of this study and also some other research on extremism is that people don't necessarily join these groups because of some intense internal hatred that they have, that very often they're joining these groups because they have some issues with their own self-identity, they have low self-esteem, they feel isolated, and they have a need for belonging. And then once they join these groups, they have to learn all of these issues around race and anti-Semitism that are a part of being a white supremacist.
And it seems that the recruiters of these organizations are well aware of this. Talk about some of the recruitment techniques that you learned about.
Yeah. So, you know, we call this the soft sell very often. And so I can share one anecdote of how one recruiter was telling us that he and some of his other affiliates would essentially park outside of high schools and look for individuals that looked like, as he called, the loner individuals that were in the back of the group walking all by themselves. And they would try to talk with that individual and invite that person to a party. And this party would just be sold as, you know, come over to our house. There's going to be beer and we can hang out and have a good time. And then slowly over time, they would ease the person into various types of extremist language.
That's interesting. So that suggests that the recruiters understand that that their ranks may not be populated by only people who come to this with hate. They've got to go find people.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, their argument would be that the public is not racially aware, if you will, or race conscious, and that what their goal is to do is to awaken people, to give people the information they need to learn about the reality that they don't see.
And how do they do this? Again, we've talked about it. So now this individual has been chosen. They've come to the party. They didn't see any racist language. But what happens over time?
Yeah, I think it's the soft sell. They're hanging out with this group. They slowly start to see things laying around like Mein Kampf. People in the group start to tell them that, you know, Hitler wasn't that bad. You know, the stuff you've learned on the History Channel it's a lie. Hitler didn't kill all of these people. What's really happened is that there's a Zionist occupied government that's made you learn to believe all of these sorts of things.
Yeah, and over time they come to believe these things. As you say, maybe low self-esteem, a loss of identity may have been what was going on with this individual to begin with. How much does that language, ideology, and doctrine play a part in constituting a new identity? Is it just auxiliary? Is it ancillary to the project? Or does it become a kind of foundation?
Oh, it's central. That's the main key, right? Yeah. So one thing we found is, you know, we don't focus on causality here necessarily. What we focus on are trajectories and pathways. And we've noticed in doing that there's a series of kind of risk factors that these individuals have around kind of adolescent maladjustment, that school problems, truancy, arson as children, abuse. Many of them had high levels of physical and sexual abuse, neglect and abandonment, and also kind of instability features in their life, a lot of suicidal ideation and mental health problems, and also problems with their family. And this is a way of saying that they had a series of vulnerable personal characteristics that made them more susceptible to the white supremacist rhetoric. And so it made them yearning for a new sense of self. Their sense of self was so weak that they were looking for an alternative. And that's what the group provided them with.
Now, we've heard similar characteristics around gang membership and other extremist groups of all stripes from all ends of the political spectrum. Are there similarities here?
Yeah, I think definitely. We know there's a lot of similarities in these processes across other types of violent extremism, whether it's far right-wing extremism or other sorts of ideologies. And I think that also with gang involvement, you see the same or similar features. Now, I will say that in much of the gang literature and research, what you see is that those folks typically are in structural conditions that are pretty rough, relative poverty in general. What we found with our sample is about 40% of them grew up in middle-class households. About 30% grew up in working-class households. Some were what they characterized as low-income or poor households. But in general, what we've seen is something that their life circumstances get worse because of their involvement in the organization, what we call kind of a mobilization downward.
And talk about the reasons they would leave. You talked to former white supremacists or members of white supremacist groups.
Yeah, so I think that we found a couple of trajectories, if you will. And I think that some of these individuals begin to have some slight questions of their beliefs, that they may have had an experience where a Jewish doctor was very helpful to them, maybe provided them services when they didn't have insurance and was nice to them. Or they have a new coworker that's a person of color that was a positive experience. So they start to question in that way, but they don't leave the group, right? They're starting to question these ideas, but there's consequences to leaving, right? This is their social belonging. This is where all their friends are and how they've, you know, kind of associated for their the last, you know, several years of their lives. So they question and stay. But then we found that there was another group of folks that leave but don't question the belief. They leave for other organizational purposes. They leave because they have an argument with the leader of the group or they're not getting along with other members. And so there's in the literature, these types of exit are referred to as disengagement, which is distancing oneself and changing one's behavior, but not necessarily changing their thoughts or their cognition. And then there's moving towards de-radicalization, which is actually changing your ideology and changing your beliefs.
And you talk about this. In fact, your study includes the phrase addicted to hate. It's
right.
Not when an individual leaves and chooses to change their ideas. It turns out it's not that easy.
It's not that easy. And I think we see that. I mean, I think if we think objectively in our own lives about making any kind of a personal change in our own lives is difficult. And these individuals have come to embrace these ideologies wholly. These are totalizing self-identities that these individuals take on. Very often they canvas their bodies in racist tattoos. They've separated themselves from their natural family. They've isolated themselves with this peer group. And all of their thoughts, feelings, and emotions now are tied up with hate. And I think in that paper, we tell a story of, and I remember doing this interview, a woman that looked at us and said, I just became tired of hating. It's so hard for me to stop hating. And I just want to be normal.
And what's the process for a woman like that or anyone who wants to be normal and finds it's difficult? What do you do?
Yeah, so right now, I mean, in general, in the United States, people are in some ways on their own. There's not a lot of support structures that are set up currently for that. There are some fledgling organizations, and one organization that myself and my co-authors have been working with is called Life After Hate. And Life After Hate is an organization composed of former white supremacists and neo-Nazis that have created what's called Exit USA. And the idea of Exit USA is it's based off of exit programs in Europe. So there's Exit Sweden and Exit Norway and Exit Germany. And there's several others across the world that focus on kind of the practical matters of life that might have been hampered by your involvement in one of these organizations, such as job training, education, tattoo removal, mental health services, substance abuse. But again, There's not a lot of support. I mean, the government's not necessarily kicking in on that right now. And I think that Life After Hate is a fledgling organization that's trying to work.
Well, the
way.
Big thing you lose, and you said it earlier, is the place where you belonged. You had a place, and these people loved you, and you loved them. And giving that up is a form of annihilation, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. So they've isolated themselves in this totalizing identity of being a neo-Nazi, and they're you know, mother and father and brother and sister maybe don't have much to do with them anymore. And now they want to get out of this group, and they face serious barriers of, one, the emotional attachments they've created, but also some potential real threats that some individuals mentioned being threatened and knowing that contracts had been taken out on their life when they tried to leave the group. To where several of them had concerns that maybe myself and one of my other interviewers might have been group members out to get them, that this might have been kind of a ruse to get them.
Michael DeMichel is a senior research sociologist with RTI International's Applied Justice Division. Fascinating research. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Matthew DeMichel. Just ahead, what is it like to lead the world's, no, not the world's largest, but the largest community college in North Carolina? And that's pretty big. We'll talk with the outgoing president of Wake Tech Community College about his 15-year tenure on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.